Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice indeed to welcome so many of you here to the second of the CELS lunchtime seminars for this term. And I have the honour and privilege of introducing to you Jacob Bomhoff, who's a lecturer in law at the LSE. And he's Dutch by origin, having done his first degree and second at the University of Leiden. But like all the best Dutch men and women, they come over here because they realise that the quality of the university sector here is so marvellous, and come and ply their trade. And I read some wonderful, wonderful things that he wrote over the summer, and I thought, it's a man I don't know, so I'd very much like to get him up here so we can all benefit from his knowledge and experience. So I leave the floor to you.
Well, thank you, Professor Warnock, for that very generous introduction. So this is very much a work in progress. It was actually the paper, the presentation, is specifically done for today. And so you'll have to forgive me for sort of the tentative nature of many of the statements I'll make. And I should also say that if you look at the title for this presentation, Perfectionism in European Law, the emphasis should very much be on the question mark in that title. So by way of caveat, I think it's important to set that out. Can you hear me in the back if I speak like this, or should I speak louder? Yeah, great. So what I wanted to do is to start off with a very basic observation and then build on that. And the basic observation is that law is absolutely central to the shaping and the functioning of the European Union. That's right. Central to the point of asymmetry with other facets of European integration, such as the political dimension, in some people's views, and a corollary of that is that the role of the European Court of Justice is sometimes seen as asymmetrically important as compared to the role of political institutions. So law is absolutely crucial. Now the role of law within the European integration project is supported by, emanates from, received within an epistemic community of lawyers, academics, practitioners, judges in particular. It seems reasonable to assume that within that epistemic community or within overlapping epistemic communities in this field, there will be prevalent images of law, sort of understandings of what good law looks like or should look like. And by way of shorthand depiction, I will use the term European legalism to describe those images or sort of pervasive trends within those images. And so then the provisional conclusion is that if you agree that law is absolutely central to the shaping and the functioning of the EU, then it may be worthwhile to try to understand any distinctive qualities of this European legalism or potentially European legalisms. And that's the project for today. And I'll just show a first slide with my project and its parameters. So the project itself is really about understanding or trying to understand at least one aspect of the distinctive nature, if any, of European legalism understood in terms of this image of law that many European lawyers will maybe implicitly adhere to. You can think of this in terms of a working theory of law within the European legal field. And I should perhaps add that the case that I just made for the heightened relevance of those images of law, the heightened relevance of trying to understand European legalism, I think is particularly strong if you accept, as many scholars do, that the nature of this image of law, this pervasive image of law, and the role of law within European integration are actually related. So in the sense that the fact that the European Court of Justice is so powerful and that the role of law is so pervasive actually depends on the underlying images of law. That wouldn't work given perhaps alternative images of law. So that by way of introduction. Now here you will see a couple of brief parameters which I'll briefly introduce to sort of set the stage and then talk a little bit more about this idea of perfectionism. But I'll have to try your patience for a second before we get to sort of any kind of working definition of perfectionism, the main word in my title. So what does the project look like? Well, a couple of brief parameters. First of all, there is of course EU law and law in Europe. And here the basic idea is that if we are looking for any kind of distinctive qualities of European legalism, it's very unlikely that EU law and broader understandings of law are going to be completely separate, right? So there has to be some kind of relation. So we're not really talking about EU law, but we're talking about a broader idea of law in Europe. At the same time, it's important to know that it is possible that the institutional or other features of the EU amplify certain trends or understandings in this broader European legalism, so that the EU context may be a very clear case or a very clear example. So there's this ambiguous relationship, EU law and law in Europe. A second point to note is the second here. I hope you can read this in the back. I'll read it to you. EU, sorry, it says constitutional law and other law. And so here there are two points to note. One is that although many of my examples today will be from the constitutional law field, it is also unlikely that if you are talking about an image of law that underlies what lawyers do, that image of law is going to be specific, entirely specific to constitutional law. But again, it may be that the constitutional context amplifies certain trends that are broader. It's also important to know, that's the second point here, that the word law is emphasized here. And so what we're looking for is really an image of law, not really an image of, say, constitutionalism or an image of political ideals, etc. We want to bring the law into the picture. Right? So that's a little bit similar to what Michelle Everson and Julia Eisner have done in their recent book on European constitution. Okay, so that's constitutional law and other types of law, bringing law back in, focusing on law, also as opposed to, for example, ideas of perfectionism in political theory and moral theory. That's an important preliminary point to make. If you think about the term perfectionism, which I'm aware we haven't defined yet, but the first association many people will have with the term perfectionism is political and moral theory, where perfectionism refers to particular kinds of theories of the good, substantive theories. I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about perfectionism in law, sort of legal perfectionism. But it is interesting to note that there may, of course, be relations between this legal idea of perfectionism, which we haven't defined yet, and political theory perfectionism. And one example, some of you may be familiar with this, Damien Chalmers wrote a paper recently where he talks about eudaimonia, the Greek Aristotelian term of sort of ideal, substantive ideals within European law. Now that is very clearly a reference to a political philosophy understanding of perfectionism, which is brought to bear on the EU. And so it may be, I'm not going to explore that today, but it may be that there are actually important or significant correlations there that may have to be explored at some other time. So legal perfectionism. Still another preliminary point. What exactly are we talking about? Well, images of law, not just constitutional law, but broader. And the third thing that I think we should expect is some kind of congruence with what we already know about law in Europe, in particular within the EU. Right? And there are some things we know about law within the EU, in particular, again, with regard to the functioning of the Court of Justice. And these are just classic debates. It would be very strange if there is no fit whatsoever with this image of law that we're trying to get at and the fact that we have a very active Court of Justice. I don't want to use the word activist Court of Justice, so I'm just using the term active. You have to be able to account somehow for the expansive approach to treaty interpretation that the Court of Justice has taken over the past decades. So there has to be some kind of congruence there. The same for formality. Right? So it's a widely described characteristic of legal reasoning, and particularly at the ECJ, that it is in some way formal or even formalist. Again, you could expect that this image of law that we're trying to get at will have to show some kind of fit with that formality. It would be very strange if there's no overlap there whatsoever. And finally, again, ECJ case law and European law more broadly is very often described in terms of teleological, can't hardly pronounce the word, teleological interpretation, or even meta-teleological interpretation, where you look at the purpose of the system as a whole. Again, it would be strange if our image of law, this perfectionist image of law, doesn't fit that idea at all. Right? So that's in terms of substantive parameters. And finally, and this is a little bit also to protect myself against possible critiques, is that if what you're doing is trying to get at a sociological understanding of pervasive images of law, then there's no guarantee that what you're going to arrive at is going to be in any way coherent. It may be that pervasive latent images of law that many of us adhere to within Europe are themselves incoherent. In fact, that's actually very likely. And I refer again to the book by Michelle Everson and Julia Eisner, which I think is very good on this point, where they refer to a basic paradox between formality, universality, and particularity, which many legal systems face. Now, that's in itself, it's a paradox. There's a paradoxical relation there, and it may be that that is actually also at the heart of this perfectionist image. So a lot by way of a preliminary introduction, but I hope that sets the scene a little bit for what we're trying to do. Now, if you want to try to get at the distinctive nature of European legalism, then my intuitive approach would be to do that through comparison. Comparison is generally a good way of getting at the distinctive nature of things. And comparison with the US, or US constitutional law in particular, has a very long and, I think, distinguished tradition in European scholarship. And so the hope is that we can maybe once more return to US law and legal thinking and try to milk that for maybe some further insights. And so this project should be read within that context. And the kind of comparison I'd like to propose is of a very particular kind, which is very much a bottom-up comparison, where you look at a range of specific doctrines, specific concepts, specific theories in US constitutional law that I'll introduce to you in a minute, that have two things in common. A, they all seem to be the expression of some kind of anti-perfectionist idea, again to be defined later, and B, they all seem very, very different from what we do here in Europe. And that's the very basic starting point. So I'm not starting with a formal definition of legal perfectionism. I'm starting bottom up by saying, well, this is a range of things that American constitutional lawyers do, and it all looks very different from what we do. And intuitively, at least, there is some kind of anti-perfectionist dimension to this. So that's one part. Now, how do I get to the label perfectionist? Well, there is actually a debate on perfectionism in US constitutional law, where these terms are explicitly used. And that debate, it's not a central debate in US constitutional legal theory, but it has some important proponents, and it's mainly built on a book by James Fleming, which is called Securing Deliberative Democracy, but people like Cass Sunstein have also contributed to this debate. And that's a debate where the term perfectionism functions specifically, and it is a debate in which many of those specific doctrines that I'd like to discuss are mentioned as opposite to what these perfectionists propose. So you see, it's kind of a bricolage way of getting at this label through lots of individual doctrines that seem to have something in common and seem to be very different from what we do, plus the existence of a specific debate on perfectionism in constitutional legal theory in the US, where many of these doctrines are again referenced. So that's my justification for invoking this term. Now, of course, you'd like to know, and I'd like to know, well, what do these people then refer to? And I'm going to present a number of varieties of perfectionism as it emerges from the literature. And this is not even a working definition. It's even far sort of a much more preliminary stage. But there are some varieties of perfectionism where I think you can see intuitively the connection with some idea of perfection. So I'll present some of these, and I'll also present some ideas that you might intuitively think of as having to do with perfectionism, but that are not discussed or defended in these American debates. Right? So what do you see in these debates? Well, for example, and I should say that these authors acknowledge themselves that they use perfectionism, the word, in 8-9 different ways. So that's nobody there claims that it's a coherent notion. What do you see? Well, some clear labels are aspirationalist, coherentist, interpretive, liberal rights, and second order. Now, I'll try to briefly present these terms. So what does aspirationalist perfectionism mean? Well, the way it is discussed in these contributions is that it is a forward-looking appeal to ideals rather than some kind of backward-looking appeal to something that has been agreed on at some point. So it's an attempt to make the constitution conform to ideals, to make constitutional practice conform to some kind of ideal in the future, rather than looking back, for example, as originalists would do. So that's aspirational, or aspirationalists. Coherentist is described as, and I'll just give you a quote, quote, perfecting in the sense of interpreting the constitution with integrity so as to render it a coherent whole. And so there you try to interpret a constitution or another legal document as if it constituted a coherent whole. And you can see that that also involves some idea of perfection. Now, of course, aspirationalism and coherentism are, or can be at least, very clearly at odds with each other. It's two very different things, claiming that your constitution embodies some kind of ideal and that you should try to achieve that ideal, and claiming that your constitution constitutes a coherent whole. And so there are more kinds of perfectionism. For example, interpretive perfectionism, which is sometimes described as trying to split the difference between these two. This is most closely associated with Dworkinian theories of interpretation, where you say, well, it involves fit and justification. You look at both the ideals and coherence with the whole. And that in itself can be an idea of perfect interpretation. And you see that very much in Dworkinian rhetoric, that the idea of law as integrity, the idea of single right answers, are all very clearly associated with Dworkinian theories. Liberal rights perfectionism is said to refer to stringency of rights protection. So a perfectionist interpretation would try to go towards the most protective interpretation in the liberal rights field. Think of some theories that you read sometimes in German constitutional theory, where they say a maximum of interpretation should be in dubio pro libertate. That's not a widely adhered to maxim, but it is an idea that you see, which also, I think, intuitively at least, has some perfectionist connotation. One final label of perfectionism to mention here is what Kasunstein calls second-order perfectionism, and I just mentioned this also by way of a caveat towards all the others, because Kasunstein says, well, actually, everybody in constitutional law is a perfectionist, because everybody believes that if you only follow their theory all the way through, you arrive at the best possible understanding of what the constitution should look like. And that's a problematic argument, but it is an important argument just to raise here to make sure that what we're trying to get at is in some way distinctive, and it's not this overarching second-order perfectionism. So I hope that gives a basic idea of some trends of perfectionist thinking. What is interesting to note is what is not discussed in these American discussions. So the perfectionism debate doesn't talk about, here it says, maximal particularity. So the idea that every case sort of should be judged on as much as possible of all the relevant circumstances, right? The all the circumstances of the case type of judging. You could associate that clearly with perfectionism, right? A rhetorically influential judge, Scalia, many of you will have heard of him, when he says the value of perfection in constitutional law is overrated, this is what he means. So nobody really defends that, but again, you can associate that with some kind of perfectionist idea. Also, they don't really talk about perfect justice on some kind of external criterion. That would be perfectionism in political philosophy, where you take an objective external criterion and you measure your practices against that criterion. That would be perfectionism in political philosophy. That is not discussed or not defended in this context. They all talk about perfecting our constitution, right? So not perfecting the constitution in the abstract, but perfecting our constitution, a specific historical document. And what is also not discussed, finally, is perfectionism in the sense of expansive interpretation or comprehensive coverage. Right? So they do talk about trying to render the constitution a coherent whole as much as possible, but they don't really talk about trying to broaden the scope of constitutional provisions as much as possible, or trying to broaden the scope of constitutional law as a whole as much as possible. And again, I think you can associate that intuitively, at least, with perfectionism. So then, what I'd like to do is, on the basis of this very preliminary understanding of some perfectionist or possible perfectionist ideas in legal thinking. I realize I've taken all the examples from constitutional law, but as I said before, their impact should be broader. What I'd like to do is present a number of these specific American doctrines that I think could be associated with anti-perfectionism. And here's a couple of examples. So it's quite a pervasive argument in American constitutional legal theory that what the Supreme Court, in particular, they always focus on the Supreme Court, does with the Constitution is clause-bound interpretation. So they interpret the individual clauses of the Constitution or of the Bill of Rights specifically by looking at the words of that clause and not really looking at the broader system. Some lawyers call this, they say, well, it's unreflectively clause-bound. That's just immediately you look at the specific wording of one particular provision. And you can see that that's opposed to, for example, this more coherentist reading that we just talked about. It's opposed to perfectionism as law as integrity, the Dworkinian variety, where you try to make your interpretation cohere with the rest of the law, etc., etc. So that's just one example. Because of time, I'll not go into more detail, but we can talk about this in more detail, of course, if you like. But clause-bound interpretation, I think, is an important example. A second is what you could call flights from substance. That's a phrase that has been used several times by different authors, and what they mean is generally they refer to either originalism or process-based theories of constitutional interpretation. So originalism, of course, looking at original public meaning or a similar concepts, so backward-looking. And process, think of theories like John Hart Ely's theory of process-perfecting theories of constitutional interpretation, where what you say is we want to get at meaning of constitutional clauses that are most likely to sort of protect deliberation and democracy, and we're not really looking at sort of the substance of constitutional clauses in terms of rights protection, for example. So these are called flights from substance. Another example, and I know this is all very brief, but we don't have so much time, and it's just to create an impression rather than, of course, discussing details of American constitutional law, in which I'm anyway not an expert. So what this is supposed to mean, popular executive constitutionalism, is supposed to mean that it is widely understood that there is the Constitution as enforced by judges, and then the whole Constitution. So it's quite widely accepted that also the executive or also the American people as such have a legitimate role in interpreting and following what the Constitution and determining what the Constitution means, and that the judicially enforced Constitution is not exactly coterminous with the Constitution as a whole. So I'll leave that as well for now. A fourth characteristic is that you have in American constitutional law a wide variety of judicial tests which are seen as not as constitutional interpretation but as constitutional implementation. Now this is important, an important distinction, I think. When you say constitutional interpretation, what you're trying to do is you're trying to take the meaning of an abstract clause and relate it to an individual case. And so you are arguing that there is a correspondence with what the Constitution or the constitutional clause means in the abstract and what it means in a particular case. That's, I think, a very brief summary. When you talk about implementation, you acknowledge that there is a difference between what the Constitution means in general or what a clause means in general and what you are doing in a particular case. There's an understanding that the Supreme Court crafts doctrine to implement rather than to interpret the American Constitution or the Bill of Rights. So what you get, and I've just given you one example here, you get situations where the Supreme Court crafts prophylactic rules. Think of the famous Miranda warning that you always see in the movies, right? You have the right to remain silent, you have the right, etc., etc. Nobody argues that that is exactly what the, I think it's the Fifth Amendment, what it means. But that's seen as an effective implementation, given lots of institutional constraints, etc., an effective implementation rather than an interpretation of the Fifth Amendment. So what you get is you get some space between the pure abstract meaning of the Fifth Amendment and its application in specific cases. going on about these judicial tests, what is interesting about them is that these tests are often incomplete and that there's a patchwork of different tests. So those, I think, are two important elements. What does incomplete mean? Well, if you look at typologies of American constitutional doctrine, you see a wide variety of different types of tests. So you have, for example, you have intents tests, you have effects tests. Right? You have tests that look at what a particular governmental measure was trying to achieve and whether that was legitimate or not. And you have tests that look at what a particular, what the impact was of a particular piece of legislation or administrative measure on an individual. And these tests, and that's quite striking for European lawyers, limit themselves to one of those aspects. So of course there are also tests that say, well, you have to look at both the aim and the effect, but there are very clearly tests that do only one of those things. And there's a wide variety of them. And they also all look a little bit different. That's this idea of patchwork here. You have areas of law in American constitutional law, say, for example, the Fifth Amendment protection of freedom of expression or the guarantee of property protection, that you really have a patchwork of lots of different tests where you go, every time you ask yourself a question, you go left or right. And then if you go left, then there's two different tests that you have to choose from, and one of those tests will be, let's say, an intents test. Right? And that's how you go through American constitutional law. You end up with a specific test that is only thought to apply to one specific category of cases, and which may be, as I said, an incomplete test. Now, a lot of this is an expression of, and that's my last criterion here, an expression of rule formalism, where you follow rules in individual cases for specific reasons, right? And you see lots of expressions of this rule formalism in American constitutional law. The tests are one of them, right? The idea that you have to go left or right, you can't go a little bit in the middle, is an expression of rule formalism. But you also, for example, have a wide range of absolute prohibitions. They're, of course, almost never truly absolute, but the rhetoric of absolute prohibitions is very, very strong. You have, for example, per se rules in lots of areas of constitutional law, where you say, in freedom of expression cases, for example, that a particular type of governmental interference with expression is just categorically prohibited, regardless of the effect. Or in property rule, for example, property law, for example, you have a rule that says that any kind of permanent occupation without compensation of any piece of property is categorically prohibited. So if I have a piece of property and the government wants to put an electric cable on it somewhere, then even though that would not at all harm the value in terms of effects of my property, it would still be categorically prohibited. So the idea of per se rules, there you see a nice example of an incomplete test. You only look at what the rule does, you don't look at wider factors, and you see a categorical prohibition. Now, I've been quite brief about this, but of course the main purpose of all of this, this is an incomplete overview, but the main purpose of all of this is that hopefully for EU lawyers, all of this should sound very strange, and it should in fact sound as almost the exact opposite of what law in Europe looks like. And of course I've presented it in that way, and there may be some exaggeration here and there, but I hope to stay at least somewhat true to the general picture of the way American lawyers would understand their own constitutional system. So, and here I'll again be quite brief, but just give you examples with which anyway most of you will be very, very familiar. So coherentist interpretation, well, that's clearly a mainstay of European law, where you look at the system of the treaty as a whole, where you take this meta-teleological approach, where you look at the purpose and the development of the whole EU legal order, and you try to fit in different doctrines from that perspective. And there's a large literature on coherent notions of coherence in European law. And even if you don't go into the legal theory aspects of that, you can see that just descriptively, coherence-based arguments are very, very important in European law. So the phrase clause-bound interpretation is not something that I think you would think of when thinking about the way the Court of Justice, to take that as a case study, interprets the treaties. This is, of course, meant to be the opposite of originalism, where you don't look backwards, but you look forwards at where the system is supposed to go, ever closer union, or in more localized instances, where you look at effet utile. And effet utile is, I think, quite often although I have not been able to find a large, I'd be very happy for happy if people could make reference on this, I can't find a large literature, or at least a literature of the size you would expect for a notion of FAU Thiele. But that's just, that may be my search capacities, limited search capacities. But in any event, there is a very clear and maximizing push behind lots of invocations, I think, of the Thiele doctrine. This, and again, I'm not explicitly relating this to perfectionism in every case. I'm leaving that at the moment sort of as intuitive connections, but I would hope that at least intuitively the connections are quite clear, or at least clearer than they were for the American case. This is meant to be the opposite of, or at least the opposite, but distinct from rule formalism in the American context. So rather than a formalism that is based on rule following, you have a formalism which is much more closely aligned with sort of German idealist practices in the 19th century, where you have a conceptual or a systemic formalism, where what you try to do is you try to build pyramids, right? Pyramids of concepts. Again, an exaggeration very clearly, but an idea that will be much, much, much more applicable to European law, law in Europe, than it would be to a law in the US, I think. There is no implementation or interpretation distinction, I think, at least in the case law of the European Court of Justice. Part of that, of course, has to do with the explicit mandate that the Court of Justice has to interpret the treaties. But it, I think it goes beyond that. That the idea is that what the Court of Justice says in its case law is an interpretation, is a rendering of the meaning of the text of the treaties. There is not the idea that there is a distinction there, that, that what the Court of Justice does is implementing, making sort of practically applicable what the treaty means. It's actually giving you what the treaty means directly. And that has important implications. Now, if you look at the rare cases where the Court of Justice sort of overrules or semi-overrules itself, they get into real trouble because they have said that before the text meant one thing and now they have to mean something else. That's very clear in something like the Keck saga. First it meant something and now it either means something else or you've always misunderstood what it actually meant. But there's only one meaning there. Right? It's not that you have a meaning that stays stable and you have a number of practical implementations that can be varied alongside that, that meaning. That's what happens if you don't have that distinction, I think. Another facet of, I think, perfectionism that's very closely related to this is the famous idea of the complete system of remedies. Right? So here you don't have, as strongly as in the US, ideas of popular constitutionalism or executive constitutionalism. The idea that there is part of the EU legal order that is not policed by the Court of Justice or any of the other courts is a very strange idea. Right? There cannot be a part of the European legal order that is not policed by a court. And so again, what you get is that the judicially enforced EU legal order becomes coterminous with the EU legal order as such. You get a perfect match there, but at least that's what the Court of Justice tends to strive for. You have not a patchwork of tests, but you have one overarching test, which is of course the proportionality test. And this test is a complete test in the sense that it's not limited to either aims or effects, but it tries to integrate aims and effects. That's exactly what is the point of the proportionality test. And you have, beyond just proportionality, you have the general principles of law that claim comprehensive coverage, that permeate all aspects of European law, again, different from, say, clause-bound interpretation or other forms of interpretation. And you have, I'll be quite brief on this, you have quite an expansive, although irregular, I should say, review of particulars in ECJ case law. So this is a very, I think, an incoherent area, but there are areas of EU law where the court is quite strongly focusing on reviewing all the particulars of the case, all the circumstances of the case, or at least telling national courts to do that. And there are at least very few per se rules in EU law. I'd be very interested in learning more about these rules from different areas of law. But even the rules that the Court of Justice announces, think of, for example, in free movement of persons, the rule that thou shalt not justify interferences based on protection of resources, for example. Even that kind, it's very rare, and it's not as rigidly adhered to as any kind of rule that you would find in American law, I think. Okay, so this is all, of course, interpreted in one particular direction. I'll be very brief on a couple of countertrends, just to make this presentation at least somewhat scientifically respectable, and then try to draw some very brief conclusions. So, what about countertrends? Well, here it says subsidiarity. I think that's a very clear case that anybody arguing for some kind of perfectionist descriptive account of law in Europe has to argue. Subsidiarity is, I think it's a difficult case. I won't say much about it except to say that a dominant view of the role of subsidiarity within the legally enforced European legal order, judicially enforced European legal order, is that it hasn't played as broad a role as political actors who introduced it would have wanted. You have lots of academics writing of subsidiarity that it's almost being written out of the treaty, for example. So you have, the case of subsidiarity may not be as problematic as it might seem at first sight. I have to leave it there. And then here, this becomes a bit more difficult. I've written famous gaps, horizontal effect of directive, standing, GECC, etc. So here what you have is you have a couple of famous acknowledged gaps within the European legal order. And you could say, well, if there's these gaps, and if these gaps are long-standing, then how does that fit with any kind of, let's say, coherent image of a complete system of remedies or a perfect match between the judicially enforced EU or legal order and the legal order as such? And here I have a couple of preliminary arguments. One is that the fact that we all know these gaps, and we always mention the same ones, tells you that there's not very many of them. What it also tells you is that they are acknowledged as gaps and they're described as gaps, which means that the background ideal or the background understanding is still a coherentist image of what the European legal order should look like. And so when you have literature, I think sort of especially mid-90s, where people write, oh, the Court of Justice has become much more cautious, much more minimalist. I mean, that's a term that surfaces then. That may have been true then, but the examples are always the same. And there may be, or I think there are, lots and lots of counterexamples. So that's, I realize this is not a sufficient argument, but it's by way of a preliminary argument against the difficulty of the famous gaps within the European legal order. So what does all of this mean? And I'll keep this very, very brief. So perfectionism with a question mark, I think the question mark very clearly remains. All I've done is sketched some intuitive connections between doctrines and some kind of background idea, but crucially also between different doctrines. And there what you get, I think, is a very clear idea of family resemblances. And it is striking, at least, that if you accept some kind of background polymorphous notion of perfectionism, that all these doctrines tend to come in groups. So that American practice and European practice or theory differ from each other along many different variables, and every time in the same direction. And I think that's important to note. And so that suggests to me, at least, that maybe there is not a fully internally coherent notion of perfectionism, but at least there are family resemblances, doctrines that, just descriptively speaking, tend to come together and tend to be collectively different from what people do elsewhere. I think that's important. The second point is that, what did I want to say here? Yeah, that on the point of coherence, that I think the idea of that there may be a paradox at the heart of all of this is very, very clear. The problem of defining something like perfectionism, I think, is clearly not unique. You have the same problem for example, judicial activism and legal formality, often used labels to describe a law in Europe. And so maybe what we should do is to look not at this end state of perfection, which may consist of perfection in lots of different directions, all review of all the circumstances of the case and building a perfect system, for example, clearly don't fit. But what is distinctive might actually be the drive towards, right? So the direction of the movement, that trying to achieve some kind of perfection, even if the ideals are incoherent, may be what is distinctive, rather than not even trying. And this brings me to the second point here, which is the distinction between faith and skepticism with regard to law. Now, that's a very often voiced observation on the differences between European law, or law in Europe, and law in the US. And, of course, we don't have to go into that now, but you can ask, I think it's an open question, whether this perfectionism label and the categories that I've talked about add something useful to that observation, whether it makes it more concrete or whether actually it's all encompassed anyway by everything that's already been said on European law and law in Europe being a law of faith and American practices being the expression of skepticism. Faith and skepticism are related to this idea of looking at perfectionism not through its end states but through the movement, the direction. Because faith, of course, in law implies that you actually think it's worthwhile to try to achieve something, and it also implies that you think that law is in principle capable of achieving those particular end states. So that's important. Related to that, I think, and this is just an observation, what all of this may point to is perhaps the fact that the European legal order, and now I'm talking specifically about EU law, is best characterized as a very demanding legal order in lots of different ways, but I'm just leaving that as a suggestion at the moment. And the final point is this, and this is actually how I got interested in this topic in the first place. If you look at this set of doctrines on the American side of the ledger, they are all very clearly associated with ideas of legal formality and formalism, right? So the idea of trying to bound, for example, discretion of judges. Rule formalism I've mentioned explicitly, but there are lots of other examples as well. And so a typical American reaction to the dichotomy that I've sketched would be to say, well, if anti-perfection is related to legal formality and formalism, then what about this perfectionism that your Europeans allegedly adhere to? Think of a notion like FAT. Doesn't that mean that something like FAT has to be the opposite of legal formality, has to be something purely pragmatic, flexible, discretionary, etc.? And that's an often voiced view. And I think that what constructing these schemes may allow us to do is to say, well, wait a minute, that might actually not be true. Maybe this idea of perfection, this demanding legal order, this legal order in which there is faith in what the legal order can achieve and what it should achieve, in fact exercises a similar constraining force on the sort of the creative space for lawyers and judges, as does this anti-perfection limiting idea in an American law. And so that there may be some kind of alternative formal dimension to notions like FAT or proportionality, for example, which is what I'm interested in, that is not recognized if you take sort of classical American definitions of formality, which tend to dominate the field. So I think that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much for listening.